Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now to the latest upheaval at the Justice Department. On Friday, the New York Times broke a story that the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had raised the suggestion of secretly recording President Trump at the White House and had speculated that the 25th Amendment might be needed. The amendment lays out the process for removing a president from office. Rosenstein denied the story, but he is today headed to a meeting at the White House. President Trump, by the way, is in New York preparing for the opening of the United Nations. So this hour, we'll consider what Rosenstein's future may look like after the New York Times and after this meeting, and the implications for his role in Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation. If you have questions about what Rosenstein's departure might mean, we'll take your calls on that. If you have observations about the politics of this, and I bet you do, we'll tackle that as well. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Our guest this hour, Michael Fontroy, is with us. He's a political scientist. No, I'm sorry. Michael, you have a new position at Howard University. Congratulations on that.
Well thank you. I have two jobs now. I guess I didn't have
Let me say them. Director of the Ronald Walters Leadership and Public Policy Center at Howard and a political scientist. And congrats again. Good to have you on
the show.
Thank you. David Levine is with us. He's an emeritus professor of law at the University of California, Hastings. And he's with us today from Oakland. And David, welcome to you. Good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. Thanks for the invitation.
Michael, CNN has reported that the deputy attorney general discussed resigning late last week after the New York Times. Is that the obvious next step for somebody who's been the subject of a story like that? Did he almost have to offer his resignation?
Yes, and it's not unusual for a person in some measure of controversy to offer a resignation. The question then becomes whether or not the president will accept it. Given what we understand their relationship to be, and there's some reporting that suggests it's actually not as bad now as it was a few months ago, I wouldn't be surprised if the president does, in fact, accept the resignation. But, of course, if he does, then there are a whole number of cascading byproducts from that that may not be any better for him in terms of the overall direction of the Mueller investigation.
Yeah, let me come back to the dominoes there. David, as I think Michael is alluding to, Rosenstein is the person at Justice who appointed Robert Mueller because Jeff Sessions had to recuse himself. Do I have the details of that right?
Correct. That's right, Carrie.
And why? Why now is Rosenstein the person that Bob Mueller reports to, and what are the implications of that?
Well, when Attorney General Sessions recused himself, as he absolutely had to because of his involvement in the campaign for Mr. Trump, Mr. Sessions had to step away. Mr. Rosenstein, the number two person, had stepped up for supervision of the investigation, and then he appointed Mr. Mueller. So if Mr. Rosenstein indeed resigns today or is fired today, then the next person who would step up would be Noel Francisco. He is currently the Solicitor General of the United States. He's the person who represents the United States in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's a very important job.
And when we say that he is essentially overseeing the Mueller probe, what does that mean he's actually doing?
Well, it's two things that are important. One is Mr. Mueller has to get authorization from Mr. Rosenstein or whoever's in that spot, if he wants to change the focus of the investigation, if a new lead comes up that may be beyond the scope of his original authority. That would be one thing, and apparently that has happened at various times during the investigation. The other thing is that at some point Mr. Mueller is going to write a report. It's going to go to that supervisor, whether it's Mr. Francisco or Mr. Rosenstein, and then that person will decide what to do with it. So let's say there is a recommendation that there be indictments. Then that supervisor would make that decision. And in particular, what about the president? And then let's say that there's a report, and the question will be, should it go to Congress for consideration, including impeachment proceedings? It is that person who will make those decisions. Mr. Mueller himself can't do it. He reports, and then the next person decides.
Okay. Call here from Cheryl in Eden Prairie. Hi, Cheryl. What's your question?
Hi.
Hi.
The article had such a dramatic effect. Shouldn't they have been more responsible in vetting the validity of this story?
Michael, there were questions about even whether Rod Rosenstein's tone was properly represented in the story in the New York Times. How do you read it?
Well, a couple ways. One, I would just say that, you know, a lot of these articles, the response to a number of these articles tends to have a bunch of non-denial denials in them. And I would also point out that the Trump administration, particularly the president, talks a lot about fake news and the failing New York Times, but they appear to accept the reporting that came out of this story, at least, which I think is at some level validation. Now, I do think that there's a fair question to ask about the issue of whether or not it effectively captured the tone. From what I understand, you know, Mr. Rosenstein has a fairly dry sense of humor and very witty, and I could see how that would get lost in print. So that makes some sense to me. But I will tell you, you know, Rod Rosenstein has been on eggshells for a while, notwithstanding the relative improvement of the relationship. And you may recall that last weekend, President Trump talked about continuing to remove the stench from the Department of Justice. I would have to believe that in addition to the Attorney General, he was also talking about Rod Rosenstein. So I'm not terribly surprised by it, although I do think it is notable. And let me just add quickly about Noel Francisco.
Sure.
I do think he is going to be the one. I know Noel, and some of you all may recall the interesting video that came out earlier in this year, I believe, or maybe it was late last year, of Attorney General Sessions, Rod Rosenstein, and a third person very publicly walking in and out of a restaurant as a sort of show of support.
Yeah.
Noel Francisco was the third person in that dinner party.
Uh-huh.
And so the Trump administration and those who want to get rid of Rosenstein might want to think twice about that. I know Noel. He and I worked together on a judicial commission here in the district for close to 6 years. He has a lot of integrity, and I do not think he's going to be substantially different than Rod Rosenstein.
Michael Fauntroy just mentioned President Trump's words about the lingering stench at the Justice Department. Here he is at that rally in Missouri talking about that.
Just look at what is now being exposed in our Department of Justice and the FBI. Look at what's going on. Look at what's going on. And I want to tell you, we have great people in the Department of Justice. We have great people. These are people, I really believe, you take a poll, I got to be at 95%. But you had some real bad ones. You've seen what's happened at the FBI. They're all gone. They're all gone. They're all gone. But there's a lingering stench, and we're going to get rid of that, too.
So, David, how did you hear that? I mean, what is the president actually saying?
To me, he's saying, here's some more evidence of obstruction of justice. I mean, that's what he's doing. He's saying, what is the stench? The stench is headed toward me in the White House. I've got to get rid of that stench.
And?
Well,
and I'm meant to do that, I'm going to take out
behind it the implication that other things will happen. And so if Mr. Rosenstein had been talking last week about resignation versus getting fired with people in the White House, then, of course, Mr. Trump may well have been signaling something like that in his speech.
And so when you say it's more evidence to you of obstruction of justice, I think you're suggesting that the president is trying to get in the middle of the Mueller probe and take out people that might be key to that probe.
Exactly.
Is that
so
right?
When he says they're all gone, every single one of them is somebody who was connected with the Mueller probe or the earlier investigations into the possibility that the Russians were trying to affect our elections.
Michael, Congressman Adam Schiff is saying today, just in the last couple of minutes, Rod Rosenstein took an oath to the Constitution, not to Donald Trump. He has an obligation to the country to see this investigation through. He is the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. But I think Congress, when they had the opportunity to debate some protections for Robert Mueller and even Rosenstein himself, did not do that, as far as I understand, did they?
Yes, that's my understanding as well. I think that what Representative Schiff is putting out is a bit of a marker. He understands that the president is somewhat limited in terms of his ability to appoint a successor. And while I think it will be Mel Francisco, just sort of technically for our listeners, the president can easily appoint anyone who's already been Senate confirmed. And I think what Schiff is concerned about is that if it isn't Francisco, that the president doesn't put someone in who would be more likely to do the president's bidding on this. And I say it in this context because I don't think there's any circumstance right now, at least, in which the president could nominate someone who could get confirmed, particularly as we're coming close to the November elections. I don't know that that person could get confirmed this year. And if the Democrats take control of the Senate next year, the president will not be able to confirm just whomever he wants. And so I think Adam Schiff is trying to, sort of bracket this a little bit, and we'll have to see where it goes.
Jeff Sessions, David, in all of this, I mean, he recused himself from this probe, but he's still the attorney general. What role does he play in this?
Well, in this probe, nothing. He has to stay away from the Russian investigation. He has to stay away from Mr. Mueller. So whether or not Mr. Rosenstein is there, Mr. Sessions' role does not change. I agree with Professor Fauntleroy that it would be extremely difficult to confirm somebody else into that position, and that really the president's only options would be to leave Mr. Francisco in supervising the investigation or to find somebody already confirmed by the Senate who's in the administration who could step in. Somebody like Mick Mulvaney, I think, is a possibility who would be willing to do the president's bidding.
Here's President Trump a few months ago in April of 2018 talking about not firing Mueller and Rosenstein.
The two gentlemen you told me about, they've been saying I'm going to get rid of them for the last 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. And they're still here.
This is life, David, in the Trump administration. You never really know what footing you're on day to day, do you?
Absolutely not. It seems like sometimes hour to hour, you don't know what's happening there. It just seems like the world's worst workplace.
David Levine with us, an emeritus professor of law at UC Hastings, and Michael Fauntleroy with us, director of the Leadership and Public Policy Center at Howard University, where he's also a political scientist. You hear us trying to make sense of some of the news that has come down this morning out of Washington, that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is in a meeting, presumably with the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, this morning. There have been reports that he offered to resign after the New York Times story last week. And we're talking this morning about the implications, as Michael Fauntleroy said, the cascading implications of what his firing would mean, what Congress might do about it, what it says about the Mueller probe, and what it says about politics. And I want to get to that as well. Your calls and questions about what Rosenstein's departure might mean, and if you have observations about the politics of this, we'll take that on too. And we're going to talk about the 25th Amendment, because Rosenstein brought that up in these apparently remarks that he thought were private. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. A question here on Twitter, Michael, from Sherry. How can individuals protect Mueller from being bullied or shut down? He seems pretty well protected so far. Do you think there's concern about his freedom to do his work?
I think there is certainly a technical threat to that, given who may be put in to oversee his investigation. But I'm less concerned about that now than I was, say, 6-8 months ago.
Why?
You know, well, because this investigation has been moving along at a very clear pace. A number of indictments, convictions, and pleas have been garnered to this point. And I think if the investigation were shut down, it would have some serious implications for the president in terms of his continuing in office. And having said all that, some of this also has to be seen within the context of the November elections, okay? No, if it happens between now and November, I'm not certain that there are going to be many members of the Senate Republicans or even the House Republicans, for that matter, who are going to want to run and defend right. whatever the president does in this regard. So I think there is a little bit of inoculation, although, quite honestly, you can never really know with this president.
You're bringing up something that I was reading about over the weekend, which is that members, GOP members of the House and Senate, went to the president to say, don't fire Rosenstein before the midterms. How much do voters really care, Michael?
Well, you know, there's so many things swirling around right now. I mean, we haven't even mentioned Kavanaugh.
Right.
It's hard to know how much voters care. I think some of that depends on where you are in the country. You know, I live here in D.C. You know, I'm familiar with the schools that have been talked about in some of these other cases. I think that here it's a really big deal, of course, because it has literal 40-year implications. By the way, you should know that these lifetime appointments have significant impact as well. But as it pertains to the Mueller probe, I think that voters around the country are less concerned about the legitimacy of knowing whether or not there was Russian collusion in the Trump administration involvement in that, because I think that's pretty well established. Mm-hmm. But we don't know the full story. And I think until we know the full story, there will be some people who are, you know, a little bit resistant to actually accepting what's really going on.
David, one of your senators, Kamala Harris, for California, said today the Senate must pass legislation to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller today. Republican leaders must allow it to be voted on. We can no longer afford to wait. This is a matter of preserving the rule of law. Doesn't look to me like Republicans are ready to move that quickly. Can you speak to this idea of passing legislation?
Well, I think it's very, very unlikely because, again, you've got Senator McConnell who is there as the leader of the Senate. And if he doesn't want something to go forward, it's not going to happen. And remember, even if something went through this House and this Senate, then it would go to the president.
Right.
And he could easily veto it. So, again, it's Senator Harris is putting her mark out there. She's a fine senator. She has her eyes on what's going on now, as well as, frankly, 2020. And so I'm not surprised to hear her issue a strong statement, but I doubt that it's really going to lead anywhere.
Call here from Tom in St. Paul. Hi, Tom. What are you thinking about?
Ties into my what's a VoIP line, but
Tom, are you there?
I am here.
Okay. I'm sorry we missed the first part of what you wanted to say. What are you asking about?
Hi, Carrie. I was talking to your person about noise on my phone.
Okay.
This morning on Program 1A, when this Rosenstein stuff was breaking, mm-hmm. one of his guests made the comment that if Rosenstein resigns, then there is a procedure already in place in which then the Solicitor General would take his place, but that if Rosenstein is fired, that President Trump could then appoint whoever he wanted. You know? And your guest a moment ago talked about that, but didn't seem to say that.
Okay.
Like he was saying,
let's ask. Firing.
Yeah.
David, firing or resignation, or Michael, which one of you can speak to this?
You want to go ahead, Michael?
Yeah, there's something called the Federal Vacancy Act, which prescribes the filling of certain kinds of vacancies, and there are some technical differences with regard to whether or not someone is fired or resigns. But I think given where we are, and I think what the signal that Senate Republicans will send, while there may be differences in how it could be done, it would likely fall to the same person, and that's the current Solicitor General, Noel Francisco.
Again, reminding listeners who have just joined us, you worked with Noel Francisco. I mean,
yes.
This is a highly pressured political situation he would step into. What can you tell us about himself, and how he might handle that?
Right. He's been around for years. He worked in the Justice Department during the Bush administration. He's argued cases both in private practice and in his government service before the Supreme Court. He's highly regarded, very conservative, and is someone who I think would calm some waters for those, particularly among Republicans, who want to make sure that the investigation sort of gets to a conclusion without being cut off.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he could be counted on to do that. Where it goes from there is anyone's guess. But I think given his connections in D.C., and he's been around a while, he's the odds-on favorite.
Todd called from Maple Grove to say, when Trump said lingering stench, and he's referring to a soundbite we played from the president in Missouri on Friday, Todd says he was talking about the negativity, the partisanship and the Democrats fighting against Republicans and vice versa. Nothing's getting done. All people are doing is hating on Trump. Todd, I don't know. He specifically mentioned the Justice Department, and I think he also mentioned the FBI, saying, look, we had a problem there, and we got rid of those people, and they're gone. So I think with that specific mention to the Justice Department, he was talking about individual people. Call here from Danielle in Mound, Minnesota. Hi, Danielle. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning.
Hi.
I want to know what your opinions are on the possibility that the Trump administration has leaked this story to the New York Times, which would enable them to do what they wanted to do for a long time, just fire Rosenstein. I'll take my answer off the air.
Michael, that's not beyond the beyond reality, because President Trump knows exactly how to work the media.
It is not. But I don't think he needed to have this story come out to have a reason to fire Rosenstein. He's been trying to do it for some time. Administration officials have consistently urged him to not do it. So I think if he wanted to do it, he just would have done it, and he would have announced it on Twitter. But to be fair, you know, we can't rule it out, which I think says something about where we are right now.
Carrie, if I could
David,
add.
David, yeah, please.
You know, I did see something that Michael Schmidt, who's one of those very fine New York Times reporters who took this story, and he explained in some detail, I think it was on Slate, about all the work that went into that story, and that he's quite sure, and I guess, and his co-author and the editors are quite sure that they have the story right. And as he described it, it was the reporters working their sources, not that somebody called them per se, and that they had a number of sources on that story, and so that they really think that it's solid, at least based on that interview with Schmidt, who I view as a very, very good reporter. It's more complicated than, let's say, Mr. Trump picking up the phone and trying to get a story planted.
Mark,
hey, Carrie, let me add quickly, if we know anything from the reporting that Bob Woodward did on his book, and I'm reading that right now, there are people in this city who are leaking like it's nobody's business. So it is no question in my mind that these kinds of stories would come out anyway.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of time.
And more power to them, as far as I'm concerned, as a journalist, right? This is the way you find out what's really going on. Okay, question here from Mark. He asks, if the Mueller reports ultimately recommends indictment of the president, Mueller will turn in his report to whomever is in Rosenstein's office. If that person doesn't follow the Mueller recommendations, then reports must be made by law to Congress, explaining why not. Michael, what would you add to that? So this person
has technically correct. That is technically correct.
Okay.
The president, the And this is all about trying to make the process transparent. So if any investigation goes on for however long it goes on, and then they reach a conclusion and pass it on to the Justice Department, if the Justice Department just sits on it and doesn't say anything, then that raises questions about the legitimacy of what the Justice Department is doing. So this provision is put in place to help make sure that things are transparent and that people can conduct themselves, or rather the public can have faith that this was a fair decision by the Justice Department. And so, you know, I think that, you know, given the way things are leaking, a report that got to the Justice Department and made the case for indictment, and the Justice Department then does not indict, you better believe that that's going to be front page news all over the city and therefore all over the country.
David, I was
Carrie, again. Yeah, I'm sorry. Please. I was just going to add one more thing, if I could.
Yeah.
Which is the current Justice Department policy. Policy statement, it's not law, is that the president can't be indicted, cannot be indicted while in office. So not only would there have to be a recommendation to indict, but also a recommendation as to why that policy is wrong or needs to be changed. So it's several hurdles that we'd have to go through before we got to the point the caller raised.
Does that indemnify the president after his term or terms is over?
Oh, no. No, not at all. No. It's just while in office. So if there were any indictable offenses, particularly think more in New York. Think about the money laundering issues, the connections with the Russians as a businessman in connection to the Trump Organization, all of that. No, it's not a full indemnification. It simply would be a postponement that the president can't be indicted while in office. So then the choice is impeachment and then further proceedings according to law, which is exactly in the Constitution. Or number two, wait until Mr. Trump's term or terms are over, and then if it was still appropriate to indict, to go ahead.
And Michael, before you go, that's part of the reason that what Brett Kavanaugh believes about that ends up being so important, isn't it?
Yes, because Brett Kavanaugh was involved in the Clinton the Bill Clinton Whitewater, Monica Lewinsky investigations, and he actually made the case for indicting a sitting president and thought that it could be done. Now, let me also add, you know, we just mentioned the money laundering. The New York stuff, the state-level law doesn't apply to this, and that a sitting president could be indicted for state-level crimes, but that's a whole other piece. And by the way, if Mike Pence became the president in the aftermath of President Trump being impeached and removed, my guess is that Pence would issue a pardon, and we wouldn't even be in this. We wouldn't have to worry about this.
Michael, thank you.
I'm sorry. But remember, only for federal offenses. Again, that would
stop
the New York Attorney General or the Attorney General in any of the other place. California, Florida, wherever else there might be financial shenanigans could still go forward.
Michael, thanks very much for the time and the insight. Appreciate that. David Levine.
Thank you.
David Levine continues with us, Emeritus Professor of Law at UC Hastings. But a look at the latest news. And Mike, I know you're watching all this news coming out of Washington.
Yes, as you have been discussing, Carrie and your guests, a flurry of information coming out of Washington this morning concerning Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. National Public Radio had been reporting he expected to be fired following reports about his early tenure within the Justice Department, but had not actually stepped down as he traveled to the White House for a meeting this morning. Sources close to Rosenstein said he believes he will lose his job following the New York Times report on Friday that described him discussing secretly recording President Trump and enlisting other cabinet officers to remove Trump from power under the 25th Amendment. Rosenstein has denied that report. President Trump says a second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is likely to take place quite soon. Speaking at the United Nations, Trump says the relationship with the country, whose leader he branded last year as Little Rocket Man, is much improved. And Dallas police say a white officer accused of fatally shooting her black neighbor inside his own apartment has been dismissed. The department fired Officer Amber Geiger today, weeks after she fatally shot the man inside his own apartment on September 6th. Court records show Geiger said she thought she had encountered a burglar inside her own home. Geiger was arrested on a preliminary charge of manslaughter days after the shooting. She is out on bond. Statewide forecast for the rest of today. We are expecting some showers in northern Minnesota. Showers and thunderstorms could develop in southern Minnesota later today and this evening. Highs today in the mid-50s to mid-70s. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 11:44.
Now there are new ways to keep in touch with the regional, national, and international news that you rely on. If you have a smart speaker, all you have to do is use the command
play Minnesota Public Radio News.
All right, here's NPR News on
Discovering What Matters.
On the next NPR News Presents, the first in a new six-part series from Neil Conan and historian Heather Cox Richardson called The Democracy Test. Danielle Allen explains democracy's ancient roots and calls for more civics education, Monday at noon and 9 p.m.
If you didn't catch our conversation about Brett Kavanaugh and the new allegations, we talked about that at 9 a.m. It's on the podcast for you to listen when you have a chance.
Programming is supported by Spire Credit Union, welcoming fall as a season for changes, like a new car or home renovations to enjoy the beautiful Minnesota views. More about Spire at myspire.com, driven by Midwestern values.
Back to our discussion now. David Levine with us from UC Hastings, where he is an emeritus professor of law. Questions now, David, about the 25th Amendment. And Pete asks on Twitter, what's the point of having a 25th Amendment if discussing it is considered a fireable offense? Isn't it a conflict of interest for the president to fire someone who allegedly was discussing whether or not he was fit for office and should be removed? I see where Peter's going with this. What do you say?
Well, maybe we should step back and explain the 25th Amendment.
Sure.
For those who don't remember it from high school. The 25th Amendment was put in place after President Kennedy was assassinated because there were concerns about the succession in office, about when would the vice president take the powers of the presidency? Would he become the president? Would he become an acting president? So there are several provisions, several of which have already been used. Something as minor as when, say, George W. Bush had a medical procedure. For a couple hours, he turned over the power to Vice President Cheney. The part we're talking about is the part that has never been invoked before. And what it requires is the vice president and a majority of the cabinet would have to certify to Congress that they did not think the president was able to carry out his powers, and that the president would have an opportunity instead to say, oh, no, I do have the power, and it would go back and forth a bit, and ultimately Congress would have to decide, but they would have to agree with the vice president and the cabinet by a two-thirds vote. So it's a very involved process. The kind of thing they were talking about was more like when Woodrow Wilson had a stroke, and the people in the White House hid it from everybody, and really Mrs. Wilson was president for a while. This kind of situation that we have now really is problematic, as your caller says, because if the majority of the cabinet were to say, Mr. President, we think you're not fit, well, the president could just fire them all.
Right.
So it's imperfect.
So again, if the president contests the decision of the vice president and Congress, you're saying a debate basically ensues that gets resolved by members of Congress at a two-thirds majority? Is that what you said?
That's right.
Can you imagine that?
The way it would
that?
Work is Congress would have a short period of time. I think it's only about 30 days once the issue is presented to them properly with this earlier process. And unless they voted by a two-thirds majority of both houses to support the vice president and the cabinet, the president would get back his powers. In the short term, the vice president would be acting president. But we would have a mess for a month or more until that all got resolved. In this sort of a situation, it's really not pragmatic, really practical to do this. Impeachment, as hard as it is actually easier than this process.
I mean, as you point out with the Woodward book, we know that this is not, if Rosenstein did indeed bring this up, we know that that's not the first time this has been discussed. But
right. It seems to have been gallows humor through the White House and in other places in the administration. It's just that Mr. Rosenstein is unlucky enough to have people reveal it.
But I was going to say, but I mean, this idea of outside people with political, I say outside of the president's office, the vice president, with political agendas, making a decision about, in this case, I think it's the mental fitness of the president. I can not imagine the country being satisfied with that.
Well, it is a very cumbersome process, and it's really not made for this sort of a situation. Again, I think what they had in mind 50 years ago was more like Woodrow Wilson, somebody who was incapacitated physically, and this would be a way to uncover that and to make the vice president ultimately the president. But this sort of a situation, when it's all political, it's just inconceivable that it would work. The last thing I wanted to say about it is that Mr. Rosenstein is not one of the people who would have a vote in this. It would be Mr. Sessions. Again, Mr. Sessions is recused only for the Russian investigation, not for anything else. So while Rosenstein might have been talking about it, kidding about it, whatever it was, he would not be one of those people who would be counted in the majority of the cabinet.
Spokesperson for the president, Sarah Sanders, has put out a statement now on Rod Rosenstein's future. And it says, at the request of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, he and President Trump had an extended conversation to discuss the recent news stories. Because the president is at the United Nations General Assembly and has a full schedule with leaders from around the world, they will meet on Thursday when the president returns to Washington, D.C. That gives President Trump, David, a few days to think about what he wants to do here. Or do you suspect that the decision is made and, you know, the mechanics are going into effect here to announce it on Thursday?
It may be. I mean, that's a pretty surprising statement, given what we heard. So it may be. It's just to give them a little bit more time to work through this. And then who knows what's going to happen. 3 days is an eternity with this White House. So we'll have to stay tuned.
Do you think Jeff Sessions at this point could have any influence on what the president does, given what the president says about Sessions when he's out campaigning?
It seems as if he would have little influence because of that. Although they seem able to work together for other purposes, I suspect that for Mr. Sessions, it would be more working through people like Don McGahn, who is currently the White House counsel, Emmett Flood, the point person in the White House who is working on the Russian investigation and who is rumored to be Mr. McGahn's successor. I think it's more likely that people like them would have an influence with the president to say, look, don't fire Rosenstein or whatever happens, more likely than Sessions.
But by the way, McGahn is consumed with the Kavanaugh hearings, and he's got his hands full with that. And I know you've been thinking about that. I wanted to ask you what you think the next step is as far as these new allegations and what happens with a potential FBI investigation.
Sure, let's turn to that. Well, of course, last night, we had that stunning article from The New Yorker. A very well-written article, very well-sourced by very careful people. Ms. Ramirez has a very clear recollection. The story explains why it took her time to come forward. But she has contemporaneous witnesses, a man who apparently was there at that party, remembers it very much the way she does, as an independent recollection. There are classmates who apparently were emailing each other early in July before Dr. Ford became a public figure, and they were talking about, hey, do you remember that time at that party? So there's quite a bit to investigate there. I suspect that it's very unlikely that the Kavanaugh hearing will proceed on Thursday as scheduled. Because it's just too much is out there. And remember, the real audience for all of this are the Republican senators who are movable on the Kavanaugh nomination.
That's Murkowski.
Collins, right. Maybe Flake, maybe Corker, people like that. If McConnell wants to get this through, he has to keep those people on board. If he loses two of them, the nomination is dead. And it's rather inconceivable to me that people like Collins and Murkowski in particular are going to say, oh, yeah, let's go forward. Let's not have some sort of an investigation. So I view it as very unlikely. We have a hearing on Thursday. Maybe it will be later. But I think all of this is, in fact, going to get investigated. And then whether Kavanaugh actually does get that later hearing, whether he actually gets a vote, I think it's very much up in the air.
So David, how confident are you that the FBI can tease out any more details than Dr. Ford has been able to provide? And now what Ms. Ramirez is saying. I mean, these are old memories,
sure.
And you know, there are not one-on-one witnesses to these incidents happening. What would you say?
Well, as to Dr. Ford, remember there's Mr. Judge, who Dr. Ford puts Mr. Judge in the room. Mr. Judge has had all these writings about the drunken bacchanalia at that school. And while he has said, I don't remember anything, it's rather different when the FBI comes calling at your door, when if you lie, you could be sent to prison. And so he needs to be spoken to. And there may be other people. Now, let's turn to Ms. Ramirez. Ms. Ramirez has got witnesses. Ms. Ramirez has this independent person, this man who Jane Mayer and Ronan Farrow have pointed to, saying that he independently, without knowing what Ms. Ramirez had said, recalls the event. And then you also have these classmates who, before all this became public, were all writing to each other. So we have emails from early July, before it became public, with those people saying, hey, don't you remember that? And so the FBI could go talk to all of those people. So she's got more corroborating evidence. Dr. Ford also has, remember, her therapist. Her therapist has notes from about 6 years ago, which have already been released. You could talk to the therapist. And her husband has knowledge from about that period when Dr. Ford was willing to start talking about this. So it is way more than he said, she said, and it all does need to be investigated. It won't be perfect evidence. It is from 35 years ago, but there's a lot there. And to me, I keep thinking about Judge Kavanaugh's veracity, that the issue is as much, what did he say now about these events? You know, he has said flatly, no way, no how, not
That's
with
right.
Ford, not with anybody else.
Right.
That's very different than, I can't remember from 35 years ago, gosh, if I did anything terrible, I apologize. That's not what he's done. He said, no way, no how, and it is consistent with other things that he said. When he's confronted with evidence that is not great for him, he just denies it in ways that aren't necessarily credible. That, to me, is more important.
We were talking about that this morning, whether there is space for him, probably not now, but whether there was a moment for him to say, I had a drinking problem, I was an idiot, as you know, some of that. I actually think some Americans would have been more likely to listen, even some women would have been more likely to listen to that.
Oh, absolutely.
Then the hard denials.
I was stunned when he came out with that wall-to-wall denial, just saying not Ford, nothing like that with her, and not with anybody else. He left him no out, none whatsoever. Instead, I totally agree with you. If he had said, it was 35 years ago, I have no recollection of this. If I did something inappropriate with anybody, I am so sorry. I was a stupid kid, and I am so sorry, and you need to look at my record over all of these years, but as to that, I cannot apologize enough. That's what he should have done. He had that moment. He didn't do that. Instead, he doubled down, no way, no how, and now it's going to come back to bite him.
David, really appreciate the insight and the legal advice here. Thank you. On short notice, I might add. Thank you much.
Oh, Carrie, I had 10 minutes notice. Anyway, pleasure to be with you again.
Thank you. David Levine, Emeritus Professor of Law at UC Hastings.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.